6 facts to know about COVID-19 vaccination for children. COVID-19 vaccination is safe and effective for children. Before recommending COVID-19 vaccination for children, scientists conducted clinical trials. Then, the FDA carefully studied the data and determined COVID-19 vaccination was safe and effective. Ongoing safety monitoring shows that COVID-19 vaccination continues to be safe for children. And the benefits of COVID-19 vaccination outweigh the risks. Getting children vaccinated can help protect them against COVID-19. There is no way to tell in advance how children may be affected by COVID-19. Even healthy children can get very sick from COVID-19 infection. Vaccinating children can prevent them from getting very sick if they do get COVID-19. Children may have some side effects after COVID-19 vaccination. Reported side effects tend to be mild, and like those experienced after other vaccines. Side effects are temporary and should go away within a few days. Some children may have no side effects. A different amount of the COVID-19 vaccine is given to children than to adults. COVID-19 vaccine dosage is based on age, not by weight or size. Children get a dose that is the right amount for them. Children who have already had COVID-19 should still get vaccinated. People can get added protection by getting vaccinated after they have been infected with COVID-19. Children can safely get other vaccines the same day they get their COVID-19 vaccine. Routine vaccination is an important preventive care service that should not be delayed. After getting your child vaccinated against COVID-19, register for VSafe to get health check-ins and share how your child feels after vaccination.
Why is the CDC not paying attention to the independent medical experts? Why does just about every statement in that piece of PR designed to push a product onto all of our children contradict so many pediatricians who put the health of their little patients first and foremost, who, you know, the doctors who say that children don't need COVID vaccines, especially if they've already had COVID, you know, they've developed natural immunity, which is supposed to be the best. And doctors who say that product is neither very effective nor safe. Why is the CDC not paying attention to independent medical experts, the ones who work with the young patients every day, like the one you're going to see here tonight, along with our own two doctors, or the ones who've examined the papers that Pfizer was ordered to release by a court that raise big questions about what's in the vaccines and the safety of injecting anyone with that stuff. Forget the sweet little voice, the happy music, the childlike cartoons that are just so cute. Let's get serious, folks, and talk to medical experts about protecting our children's health. That's exactly what we're going to do. You've come to the right place. Welcome to the FLCCC Weekly Update. I'm Betsy Ashton, Creative Director of this alliance, and medical professionals and many, many, many supporters. And we have a nurse already online to take questions that you type into Q&A, but I'm an old investigative reporter who always wanted that independent opinion of any product that some company was pushing or of any plan that a government agency insisted that we use and, of course, pay for with our tax dollars. I wanted to talk to someone whose career was not riding on the sale of the stuff, who didn't have a financial interest in it of any kind. Well, in the case of this particular product, we're getting that analysis. We're not getting that analysis from any of the media that we used to trust, but we have independent experts here tonight, as I said. You know, I'm delighted to welcome two doctors that you all know and love so well, Dr. Paul Marek and Pierre Corey. They're here to dig into this topic of what is the best way to help children avoid or get over a COVID infection. And with them, we have a top pediatrician who literally was treating a patient just moments before we went on the air tonight, Dr. Lawrence Pilewski, whom you probably already know him from his own podcasts and webinars on the holistic approach to children's medicine. So welcome, doctors. I will be back with questions for you at the end of your talk. But first, tell us what you think of that splendid little feature from the CDC, or should I say commercial?
Well, thank you, Betsy, for that introduction. And it's great to see both Dr. Corey and Dr. Marek. Thanks for inviting me this evening.
Thanks, Claire. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you. I think the little video that we just saw is keeping in line with the decades of gaslighting and propaganda that we've seen from the authorities, who have all asked us to trust them because they are the authorities. And I think the wonderful piece about it is that more and more people during the last 3-4 years of COVID propaganda have been able to critically analyze what that video says, and they've been able to think on their own. And if anything a piece like this has done, it is given people pause and cause to think. I don't have to go through every single bit of what was said, but all we have to do is start at the word vaccine. And if we critically evaluate what this injection is, I think we could very well explain in great detail that this isn't even a vaccine. And why would I say that? I would say that because, let's say, for instance, this is mRNA technology, which, again, we can't be sure that it is, because we've not seen studies that actually monitor the effects and the mechanisms of this injection on the body. But let's just say for a second, and suspend any mythology here, that this is an mRNA technology. Can anyone in the medical world, the scientific world, the political world, the social world, look in the past and see that an mRNA technology vaccine has ever been shown to reduce or eliminate the presence of an infectious illness? And the answer is no. So we have no precedence whatsoever that should this be mRNA technology, that it would be effective in reducing or eliminating the incidence of an infectious illness. Now, many in the world who have listened to some of my work know that I don't even think COVID-19 is an infectious illness. But I don't think we need to get into that discussion unless you really want to. But just from the fact that we've never used this technology before, should this be the technology they say it is, we have no historical precedence that it would take care of any infection whatsoever.
Larry, the other thing, and you're talking about the efficacy that it wouldn't work, or there's no evidence that technologies work. But to me, what I've been writing and sort of looking at now is the lack of safety evaluation. There's so many aspects of this technology that was not evaluated.
But Pierre, I don't think we have to stop at COVID-19 injection.
Yeah. That's
to
true.
Support what you just said. I think, you know, it is just a continuation of the same process of not testing for safety and them using a language and certain tools to convince the public that it has been tested for safety. I mean, this shot, we don't even know the full ingredients of this shot, but those ingredients that we do know, we know are different than any of the ingredients we've ever used in the past. And so where's the sort of, again, the mechanisms, the technology, and the results that show us when lipid nanoparticles are injected, when these hydrogels are injected, this is what happens to the chemicals once they're injected into the body.
Yep.
And none of that has ever been done for any injection, let alone the COVID-19 shots. So again, there's this inner, like, I can't possibly conceive of the fact that an authority that's supposed to protect me would do mm-hmm. something to not protect me. And I think once that belief system is cracked, we have the groundswell that we have, which is people are not only looking at the propaganda of the COVID shot, but they're looking at the propaganda of all the shots that yep. they've been duped into getting for their kids for decades. And I'm meeting so many families who never would have questioned any of the shots until they realized they needed to question the COVID shot. And as both of you know, you're not allowed to question if you're going to live in this country, because if you question, you're a heretic, you're anti-science, you need to be ostracized, you're misinformation, because we've gotten to the point in science and medicine where questioning is no longer scientific. And, you know, we all know the dangers of that.
Yeah. So, Larry, how do you deal with that with your patients? What do you tell them, or what don't you tell them? Or what kind of discussion do you have with them?
Well, I do let them know. Well, before I even answer that, none of the patients who come in to see me in the office actually ask me, should I get a COVID shot for my child? Because they already know a priori that this is not a shot they would ever put in their kid.
Even new patients, Larry?
Even new patients.
Who don't know about you and your expertise and your background? Well,
they don't come to me unless they're looking for something that I can provide them. Because, you know, they know that I don't sell any shots in my office. So they know that I try to limit the amount of pharmaceutical prescriptions that I write. So they know that I'm going to look at the practice of Western medicine from the science of the body having the innate capacity to heal. And they know that I'm going to prescribe to them ways to get to the root causes, the maintaining causes of inflammation and disease in their kids' bodies. And they're looking to get away from the pharmaceutical model. But they also know that I'm practicing Western medicine.
Yeah.
So could I ask you, since you brought it up, do you use any shots in your practice?
No. I have not sold shots in my practice since I left a practice in October of 2002. And even when I was in that practice for 2.5 years, from April of 2000 to October of 2002, I only offered the shots to those patients who walked in asking for them. But most of the families in that practice did not want shots. And I started to welcome parents into my practice in 1998, who were already more advanced in the understanding of the problems with shots than I was at the time, and then gave me an education boost. And then it just snowballed, because I did a deep dive into the literature, and to find the literature around safety and efficacy, that didn't take me long. It was a couple of minutes to find that I found nothing. And then to do the deep dive about lack of safety of ingredients, lack of safety testing of ingredients, lack of real regulation of safety and manufacturing. And then, of course, finding out about the 1986 Vaccine Injury Compensation Act to realize that the companies had almost no liability. They had some liability, but that was completely wiped away in 2011 when the Supreme Court just said, you know, they're unavoidably unsafe, and now we're going to give you full immunity to any liability. So it was clear to me very early on that there was a really bad problem with what we were being told and what was in the literature. And I just invoked the precautionary principle really quickly and said, I can't in good conscience do this if I don't have good, firm science to support that I'm not only going to give you something that's safe, but I'm going to give you something that works, because the literature didn't even secure the idea that it worked. Because when when I finally looked at all the data, and you realize that 3 to 10% of vaccines are given to 3 to 10% of kids who get vaccines have no antibody response. Huh. And so then there's who knows how many, 10, 20, 30, or 40% of kids who get an antibody, but it's not an antibody that protects them against the organism. And then how many kids do get an antibody that's protective? And then how many kids do get an antibody that's protective that only lasts for a couple of months? And so you're looking at more than half of kids who get shots where there's no benefit. Immunity at all.
So Larry, how can you explain the fact that you can see the truth, which is clearly obvious? I mean, this is not difficult to see. And yet almost all of your colleagues are wandering in la la land. They're just out of touch with reality.
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. One, in the past 30 years, as you both know, hospitals and practices were bought up so that doctors had to be employees of a big system. So that really limited independence. It limited independence in decision-making, in protocols that they used, and it limited their independence in critical thinking. And so they had to follow what they were told. Their bonuses relied on it, their total incomes relied on it. And so doctors were kept in line not to say things that were against what they were being told. And the other thing is that I even had a mother in the office to me today who said that she went to the pediatrician and they said that they were going to allow her to stay for a little while if she didn't want to vaccinate. But the appointment was really short because there was nothing else that the doctor really had to say to her, because the visit is centered around vaccinations.
Yep.
And then when you delve into the insurance companies giving practices bonuses based on percentages of vaccinated kids in their practice, so you could see that it became a monetary incentive to give the shots, to push the shots. I mean, rotavirus is not a vaccine that's mandated for school, but yet the majority of practices are still pushing it.
Ugh.
And hepatitis A is not a vaccine that's mandated in every state for school, but yet practices are pushing it. But I think, besides the political stuff and the economic stuff, I think it boils down to what happens to the Liberty Bell that's not cracked? What happens to the Liberty Bell in our hearts that then has to realize that we've been lied to and duped, and that we've been doing something to harm kids for decades? So that is a deep soul searching. And both of you know it. You know the process. And I remember in 1998, when I first saw this, I felt like I was standing on two sides of a crack in the land. And I either stayed where I was in a system that would not acknowledge the science that I was realizing, or I go to a system that I had no idea what I was going to.
Hmm.
How do I practice medicine without these shots? And I jumped. But I jumped because I wasn't going to be involved in an insurance model. I wasn't going to be involved in a selling model. I was going to be involved in a shift of a paradigm where I could actually practice Western medicine and not use pharmaceuticals and injections and be successful.
Hmm.
And, you call it holistic. Others people called it alternative, integrative. But I practice Western medicine. Like, I practice based on neurology, immunology, cardiology, all the ologies, having run a pediatric ICU, having worked in an ER that both of you are very familiar with. And once you get down to the basic sciences, you realize the body does have the innate capacity to heal. And that the reason for symptoms may actually be the resolution of disease, not the onset of disease. And so we have a whole way of practicing Western medicine that doesn't require suppression of symptoms, that actually could support the body's resolution of symptoms to create better health. And I remember, you know, practicing in New York City in the 1980s in medical school and residency. I mean, I had mentors who had practiced since the 1940s. And they would always say, if we let our kids in our practice have their flus and their measles and their mumps and their chicken pox and their fevers, and we didn't interfere, they almost always had a developmental growth spurt. And when you realize that that's the old medicine that's just been lost, you realize, well, wait a second, is there a benefit to acute illness? And so now that we're injecting all these shots and we're suppressing kids' illnesses with antibiotics and over-the-counter medicines and other pharmaceuticals, we have the highest number of chronic illness kids in the world. Why? Because we're not allowing the resolution of waste removal during an acute illness. So we're suppressing it because we're calling it an infection. And then if it doesn't resolve with the medication, we add another one. And then if it doesn't resolve, we add another one. And then over time, you have a kid who can't sleep, can't sit still, snoring, is not paying attention, is lost speech. And so all the suppression of with medications. And what do you think can happen to a medical doctor who went through 4 years of medical school, 3 to 5 years of residency, and then gets to learn that everything they were taught might have been a lie? I mean, you guys know it. I've been living with it for 25 years.
I think we learned it late, Larry. That's the
no,
difference.
You learned it on time.
Okay, I like that.
You learned it on time for your process. I was hit in the head with a 2x4 25 years ago. So, you know, there's no way to know why things happen the way they do, but,
What was the 2x4? Was there a specific event or experience with a patient, or what prompted you to start doing that deep dive into the literature?
Well, I remember in my fellowship, I was in a fellowship in an outpatient clinic at Bellevue in New York. And I remember it was 1991. And I remember the hepatitis B vaccine being mandated for all newborns. Now, I had no reason to question vaccines.
Yep.
But I was a critical thinker. And I said, wait a second, polio was developed because there was a polio illness in kids. The HIV vaccine was developed because there was a Haemophilus influenza B meningitis and epiglottitis. Wait a second, measles, mumps, rubella was developed because we were seeing measles, mumps, rubella in kids. Hepatitis B vaccine was developed because, wait, we never saw hepatitis B infections in kids. And we didn't see, you know, adverse long-term sequelae either. So I made the question, why are we giving this shot to kids? It's not a disease entity in infancy, pediatrics at all. And my colleagues looked at me and said, well, because we have to. And that died until 1995, when I said to a colleague who was in private practice, who taught me in medical school 10 years earlier, I said, Mike, are you giving this shot in your practice? And he said, yeah. And I said, why? It makes no sense. He said, I know, Larry. But I said, so why are you doing it? He said, because we have to. And then in 1998, this is when it clicked a little bit, because I had already started to shift my thinking about diet, nutrition, healing, alternative medicine. I was learning from acupuncturists. I was learning from homeopaths. I was learning from osteopaths and naturopaths.
Larry, can I just interrupt to say, that's all I've been doing for a year and a half. Like, practice now, which is, you know, vaccine injury, long vax and long COVID. I mean, I'm working with whole bunches of different ones that I was in the system before in the ICU. I didn't interact with all those disciplines, and it's been really kind of mind expanding, very interesting. It's been one of the most stimulating times of my life.
So before I get to answer your first question, I want to answer what you just said. I was in about 1993, 94, while I was an ER doc, I met a nurse who was in acupuncture school. And she sent me to an acupuncturist who I started working with and then asking like tons of questions. She sent me to a chiropractor who then told me the body has an innate capacity to heal. And I just went like, what? You know, you have a convulsion. Because like, what is that? That doesn't mean anything to me. I'm a medical doctor. And so I started searching for all these answers about the body having the innate capacity to heal in all these alternative medicines, only to realize by the early 2000s where that information sits in the body of science that we're taught in medical school. The immunology, the neurology, the cardiology, the gastroenterology, the hepatology, all of that is in the basic sciences. We just don't practice it. And so for over 20 years, I've been using those ologies. And you know, Paul and I talked about this last month when we met in person, where I showed him, you know, how the immune system is built and how the autonomic nervous system is built to actually heal the body without interference. And we just don't pay attention to it. And it's all there in the literature. It's there in the ER work. It's there in the ICU work. We just ignore it. So, I mean, that's a larger discussion that we can have.
You know, and you just brought up something that I used to think about when I was working, like in the ICU and pulmonary, which is that I once read a definition of the difference between a physician and a surgeon, or a medical doctor and a surgeon. And one is that, you know, a medical doctor believes that a patient can sort of heal itself, or a disease can be, you know, sort of responded to by the body. Like, you have a belief that the body can fix itself, or can, you know, resist things. Whereas a surgeon feels like they have to fix it. And the reason why you reminded me of that difference is that I worked with a lot of surgeons as an ICU doctor, and I saw surgeons, they went after and fixed everything. They were like fixing every little electrolyte and they would get disturbed when I would consult on their patients, because I was way more hands off than them. I was like, I didn't have to fix every single little thing. And it's just a very different philosophy. Just that's a little off topic, but
yeah.
But what you're saying is applicable to much more than that.
Sure.
So, Larry, do you want to give us an idea of the kind of things you actually do, the interventions that you do? Sure. What do you recommend? So, you know, a patient, for example, comes in with otitis. How would you approach such a patient?
So we know in Western medical teaching that the eustachian tubes, the ear canals of children, are more horizontal. And as kids get older, they become more diagonal. So we also know that the ear canals are lined with mucus and microorganisms, the same way the sinuses, the nose, the nasopharynx, the larynx, the whole entire airway and intestinal system and skin are lined with mucus and microorganisms. And so I teach parents, why are those microorganisms there on a regular basis? Well, they're there to help the body remove wastes. And they're there to help protect the body so wastes don't go in. I said, so on any given day, there's mucus that's also helping to remove the wastes. And that's why the body produces mucus, to protect the body from waste going in and to enhance the removal of waste going out. And so if you see more mucus, you mean there's more inflammation, there's more wastes coming out. The problem is that the canals, the ear canals, drain into the nasopharynx right where the adenoids are sitting. And the adenoids are lymph tissue associated with the intestinal system. It's part of the gut. It's part of the gut-associated lymph tissue. So I explained to parents that the adenoids and the tonsils are part of the 26 feet of intestinal lining of the immune system in kids that is responsible for trapping wastes and getting rid of them. And so if there are a lot of wastes coming out of the gut, they're going to shoot right up to the head and the neck through the lymph system, and the adenoids and the tonsils are going to swell. And more wastes are going to come out through the sinuses and through the ear canals. And so what happens if there's more mucus and there's more wastes and there's increased size of the adenoids? Drainage suffers. And so the only reason for the inflammation that hurts in the ears is because drainage is poor. And so once we reduce the foods that are coming in that create the inflammation, and once we do massages with essential oils and lymphatic drainage, and once we do chiropractic and craniosacral work, and on the really daring kids, if I can put my finger into the kid and put it behind the uvula on the soft palate and pull down, I'll release the entire area to drain and the kid will get relief. Because otitis is not an infection. It's an inflammatory process and an anatomical obstruction. And so the literature started in 1990 out of Europe to show that otitis can be treated without antibiotics. And then in 1997, a study in American literature and pediatrics came out, and another one in 2003 that said, if parents were given a prescription for their kids' ear pain and waited 24 hours, minimum two-thirds of the parents did not give their kids antibiotics. And so even with the literature in the last 33 years, no change in practice has occurred in the pediatric medical world. And so kids are being treated inappropriately with antibiotics for something that's a highly inflammatory process that just needs better drainage and good dietary shifts. And I mean, I haven't used antibiotics, I don't know how long, for a kid with ear pain, because it's an obstruction. It's merely an obstruction. It's a drainage problem with lots of inflammation. Now, just because a kid is in pain doesn't mean a kid is infected. It purely means that the kid's inflamed, and inflammation just needs to be drained. And one of the best ways to do it is to, one, stop putting it in. So the dairy, the flour, the sugar, the yogurts, the ice cream, the muffins, you know, all those processed flour products. And to get a good, I have this all on my website in the section, if your child is sick, and good essential oil massage, good ways to open up the airways, and good craniosacral or osteopathic or chiropractic medicine.
I was going to say, you sound like an osteopath, Larry.
Well, I'm
just...
A little
mix of everything.
I'm just practicing Western medicine.
Do you use any nutraceuticals?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, I use herbs called gemotherapies, which are very, very much more popular in Europe than they are in the States. But these are herbs that are extracted from buds. So like the new shoots, the new roots, and the buds of plants in the spring. And they contain the stem cells, which are pluripotent. And there are great gemotherapies that help drain the upper respiratory system, and they work. I mean, I've had kids on them for chronic conditions, and I've had kids on them for acute conditions. Again, as I said, I use essential oils, I use probiotics, omegas. I use more minerals than I do vitamins, because I feel like kids respond better to minerals. Some of the vitamins make more kids wig out, like the B vitamins, even though they're theoretically good. I use some antioxidants, but vitamin DK is a big thing in my practice. But yeah, for the most part, that's really where I start. Homeopathy is part of what I use. Tissue salts, which are the Schussler cell salts, I use those. Those are great. There are 12 of them. They're great for ear pain. They're great for upper respiratory congestion. They're great for teething. They're great for runny nose, for fever. That's a lot of what I use.
Do you ever use traditional analgesics?
No. I don't. Yeah. I don't. I mean, and I you, think.
And cool. Your patients get away with pain relief?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the thing is that, you know, I have to remember that I'm not there. So I'm not the parent who may be stressed or freaking out because they are seeing their kid in pain and nothing's working. But if the parents learn homeopathy, they can get rid of that kid's symptoms like that with acute treatment. If they learn the use of cell salts, they can watch the kids get better. The gemotherapies, the essential oils, those things work quickly. I actually am okay saying that acetaminophen is more toxic to the body than vaccines. Like, that's a drama. That's a drama statement for me. And I'm okay saying that because, as we all know, glutathione is one of the most important antioxidants and detoxifying agents in the body. And when you're sick, you need your glutathione, because the reason for the illness is not an infection most of the time. It's your body's trying to cleanse the inflammation. And so if you, you know, I'm going to use this funny statement. If you rob from Peter to give to Paul, you know, you're losing your glutathione. You're not able to detoxify. You're not able to cleanse. So I think it's a very toxic drug. The literature shows it, guys. When you look at the mothers who take acetaminophen during pregnancy, increased ADD and ADHD, increased neurodevelopmental disabilities. It's a toxic, toxic drug. Motrin or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, again, it reduces stomach acid. It lowers blood flow to the kidneys. I don't think these are safe drugs. If parents are doing it one shot here, one shot there, they might get away with it. But it, to me, it's not a safe drug. And what I see is when parents use suppressive medications to stop the fever, three things happen. One, fever goes away. And that's not a good sign, because the baby needs the fever to burn out the rest of the stuff. Two, the fever goes higher, because you've told the body, I don't want you to burn. And the body says, heck no, I've got to burn. I've got to get this out of here. And three, the fever takes longer to go away in numbers of days, because the body says, all right, you're tying my hands behind my back. I've got to get rid of this junk. Now it's going to take me longer. And parents start to realize that. And, you know, we all know that we have our edge where we can tolerate what we're doing. And so some parents just have to give the Motrin. They'll deal with the delay and the fever going away. But others are beginning to learn that once their child goes through those illnesses unscathed, they're stronger, they're better, they sleep better, they talk more, they eat better, they walk better, they do things better. And that's a hard sell when over the last 30 years, we have taught parents, you need to medicate, you need to suppress, you need to get rid of the symptoms. Don't let your kids suffer. And it's hurting the kids a lot.
Yeah. What kind of dietary advice do you give to parents?
Well, a whole foods diet. You know, anything in a package is really not the best thing for your child. And because, you know, if we study Chinese medicine and we understand that and Ayurvedic medicine, we understand that the digestive system is a fire, it's an oven, it's a cooking system. And when babies are born, their digestive fires are inefficient, meaning they're not going to be able to have the oomph to fully digest their food energetically the way we might be able to. And so we want to avoid giving them cold, iced, and too many raw foods. We want to, because that threatens the health of a fire that has to cook its food. We don't want to give them too much damp foods, mucus-producing foods, because dampness, sugar, juices, yogurts, smoothies, you know, muffins, pancakes, these are all very damp, you know, and mucusy foods. Those also compromise the health of the fire. And we also don't want to overfeed them. So we don't want to give them too much. We don't want to stimulate them too much, because that actually means that the digestive system is constantly swallowing and swallowing and swallowing. And that digestive fire just peters out. I mean, it just can't do it anymore. And so we look at a whole foods diet. I love to get kids to eat seasonally. So when it's summer, you can tolerate more raw foods. When it's winter and fall and winter, you want to eat warm foods, cooked foods. You want to go away from the salads, away from the juices, away from the smoothies, away from the raw foods, and more towards the soups, the stews, casseroles, roasts. And, you know, parents look at me and go, well, how am I going to get my kids to eat that? And I said, well, first of all, kids learn by imitating. They don't learn by what you tell them. They learn by mimicking. And so if you model it, they will do it. And then I'll say, well, my kid won't eat anything. I said, not yet. But if you only give them what they want, they're not super attentorial enough to know what's in their best interest. So kids are always going to want what they want and not know it's not good for them. That's our jobs. Our jobs are to give them what's in their best interest. And that's the skill. That's the sort of finesse of parenting, is when do you make the change that, you know what, I love you dearly. I know you're going to have a fit because you want this, but I can't give it to you because it's going to keep you up all night, or it's going to worsen your mucus, or it's not going to be good for you. And so, you know, parenting becomes a big piece of it. And, you know,
so in essence, you've got to change the parents' diet to change the kids' diet, because the kids are going to model what parents are doing.
Right. And, you know, that's another addiction habit that we have to deal with as well, because, you know, parents also have their, no, I can't give that up. But in the over 20 years that I've been doing it this way, if I can get a parent to have an experience that they then learn for themselves, they feel better, I can step back. Because the idea is to really look at parents and say, I tell you what, I know this is hard for you. Do yourself a favor. Do an experiment. Just try it. See what happens. Give me a month. Humor me. Okay? Make me wrong. Make yourself wrong. And so I have to use humor in situations like this. Because, you know, Oscar Wilde said, if you're going to tell somebody the truth, you better use humor. Otherwise, they'll kill you. And I've felt that in my practice. And being a New Yorker and having the New York sense of humor and a little sarcasm and a little finesse, I have to do it. Because, you know, we need to move towards hell. Little by little, some people take the local train, some people take the express train, and then there are those who are not going to take the train at all. And that's okay. That my job is just to offer the opportunity for the shift. And those that take it, they get it. And once it's their experience, I just support them. I just continue to guide them. My job is to step back once they get it.
Do you think there's ever an indication for antibiotics, or when do you prescribe antibiotics?
Well, those are the kids that have pneumonia with respiratory distress, decreased pulse ox, and tachycardia, tachypnea, and retractions. Those are the kids who have cerebral spinal fluid positive for E. coli, GBS, streptococcus pneumonia, Neisseria meningitis. Those are the kids whose knees are blown up, and after tapping the knee, there's a gram stain. Well, I don't even think they do gram stains anymore, but because we did when we were residents, and I have a positive culture. Those are the real times where I think antibiotics are necessary. I'm not there. Those are the ones that are already in the hospital. So I do believe that there's times. But I'll tell you, for most things, I don't have to use it. Even for certain impetigos, I've gotten away with topical treatments, some nutraceuticals, and not using oral antibiotics. I'll even use some topical antibiotics, and it works. Essential oils work really well in those situations.
Interesting stuff. I've got to jump in here because we got a lot of good questions from our audience.
Okay.
Oh, yes. They want more information from you. And here's one, since you talk about the parents learning, you know, one of our Rumble viewers says, how do we parents start to learn basic homeopathy to treat our kids? Where do you send them?
I mean, there are schools. I mean, I don't know if parents want to go to school, But there are well-known homeopaths around the country and around the world who offer ABC courses. And there are also very simple ABC homeopathic books, little ones this big.
That's good. They don't have much time, right?
No, they don't. But there are, I mean, there are some, and I also want to say that there are different kinds of homeopathy. There's classical homeopathy, which only recommends one remedy, and you step back and you watch. And then there's other types of homeopathy, like the French do, where they'll give you five remedies, which might cover the symptoms that the kid has, because one of those remedies is probably the right one. And sometimes that works. But, you know, the purists are going to do, you know, constitutional homeopathy, one remedy and you stop and watch. I like that kind because I'm a purist, but, you know, people have had success with other types.
Okay, here's a question that you were talking about fevers, and well, Christina wants to know, how high a fever can the body tolerate? Are there any alternatives to the NSAIDs and Motrin that people can use for high fevers?
Okay, so in 1993, while I was still an ER doc, I went to one of my colleagues who practiced in New York and thought about the possibility of going into private practice. And I was trained that kids between the ages of 3 months to 2 years with a fever of 102.5 or higher with no source of infection needed a CBC, blood culture, and urine culture. And I said to him, Harold, what do you do for these kids in your practice? He said, Larry, if I did those tests on every kid, I'd lose the kids in my practice. I said, so what do you do? This is what we're taught in, you know, residency. And he said, if you had a child with 104 fever who was looking at you, talking, engaged, a little quieter, but drinking and related, and then you had a kid who was 100.4, who couldn't lift his head, his tone was lower, and wasn't talking, which one would you be worried about? And I said, the one with 100.4.
Yeah.
And so I'm a clinician, and I was trained not to look at the number on the thermometer. And all ICU docs know not to rely on the monitor, but to look at the patient sitting in the chair whose flatline monitor might actually stimulate the idea that the kid, that the adult needs a code. When they walk in, the lead fell off and the patient's eating lunch. Right. So we're looking at the kids, and I don't worry about the number on the thermometer. I don't like the forehead thermometers. I don't like the ear thermometers. If you're going to take a temperature, I look at the rectal thermometer, but I look at the kid, and I have a whole checklist on my website in the section, if your child is sick, of how to tell when there's something to be worried about. And so I don't care about the number as much as I care what does the child look like. And I never recommend a cold bath for kids with a high fever because it creates more stress. And that creates more adrenaline. And that creates more inflammation. And that creates more cytokines. And that creates more fever. So really a warm bath or a hot bath or sweating under the covers, which helps the kids sweat, which then evaporates the water and the kid's temperature goes down. Mm-hmm. And so this is just basic science. This isn't alternative medicine. This is basic physiology. So I'm always looking at the kid, alert, awake, arousable, interactive, talking, head tone, you know, drinking fluids, urinary output, breathing patterns, color of the kid. These are the things that I'm most interested in. And that's clinical medicine to me.
Yep.
But again, I
love your clinicians. That's right. There's no question about that. Now, we got to go back to the vaccines, though. Jenna wants to know, she says, Dr. Pilevsky, is there a setting where vaccination is an appropriate disease control measure? For example, what is the best way to prevent morbidity and mortality from things like measles and tetanus in places where nutritional resources are extremely limited?
Okay. So if we go back to the early parts of the 1900s, you'll hear all this information about how measles killed this number of kids. And then when you start to realize that sanitation, hygiene, better living conditions, better nutrition, all reduce the mortality rate from measles, you realize that all of that happened before the shot was implemented in 1963. And you realize, if you go into a deeper dive, that measles is rarely a complicated illness for kids. And then if you go off on a tangent, you realize that measles may actually be an illness of toxic exposure in the environment and not a viral illness at all. But that's for another discussion. But I just wanted to throw it out there that if we're going to be scientific, we want to look at all the things that are in the literature. And certainly we're at a time where illusions are being shattered and truths are being shattered. So I just want to put it out there that it may be a sign of toxicity, and the resolution of the toxicity is the illness. Tetanus, I mean, this is so fascinating. Tetanus is a bacterium that only lives where there's no oxygen. It's an anaerobic bacterium. And so if a child gets a cut and the cut bleeds, there's blood, there's oxygen. And so the real worry for tetanus is when there's a puncture wound.
You step on a nail. Yeah.
Well, at least a puncture wound that doesn't bleed. And really, the advice in that case is to cut it open, let it bleed, and irrigate the hell out of it. But most kids who are playing in the soil and in the dirt will breathe in the spores of the tetanus bacterium, especially if animals have walked and pooped in that dirt or in that grass, because the aeration of the tetanus spores allows them to swallow them and then develop immunity against it. So when I see a kid who has a cut, my first bit of recommendation is let it bleed. Not to bleed out, as many of us would say, but let it bleed. And then once it bleeds, you irrigate it really, really well. Water, if you have saline, and clean it out. And bleeding and irrigation are the two biggest steps to prevent infection and any bacterium from getting in there that shouldn't get in there.
Would you add a disinfectant, or you just bleed and irrigate?
Bleed and irrigate. And I actually recommend turmeric powder.
Okay.
Because turmeric powder is a disinfectant, as you said, but it's also a clotter. So it helps the blood clot so that the wound would stop bleeding and then the wound will disinfect. And it works. It works all the time. But a puncture wound, again, is a case-by-case basis. I still want that wound opened, as you know.
Okay, now, Arthur Morris wants to know, do you think that any vaccines at all, even those developed and given 60 years ago, were of value in eradicating disease?
Okay, so in the shattering of illusions, I would question whether the myth that vaccines eradicated diseases 60 years ago is actually true. Because I, in looking back in the literature, would actually venture to say, with enough scientific backing, that that's not true. And again, that's for another time. And I don't say that flippantly. I say that with scientific support and backing. And if you're really interested, Dissolving Illusions is a wonderful book by Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, who could begin the process of explaining how the polio vaccine had nothing to do with the actual so-called eradication of polio, especially because polio may not have been a viral illness in the first place, shattering of illusions. So in my understanding of the science of shots, I've come to the conclusion that the risks to these shots, without safety testing, without proper manufacturing, without proper hygiene of the shots with unknown quantities and qualities and ingredients, that the risks far outweigh the benefits, especially because there are known ingredients in the shots, known things we already know, that will inflame the brain, that will destroy mitochondria, and that will lead to immunological and neurological damage. And again, I'm not saying this flippantly. I have all the science to prove it. It's just a matter of whether the stomach can actually swallow the information and whether the heart can then open up and say, oh my God, oh my God.
We have, you know, Betsy, it's probably a good time to to again cite the books. I mean, you just cited Dissolving Illusions, but there's Turtles All the Way Down, which I can assume many of our supporters and viewers have read. But when you talk about that science, for me, it's so well put together and packaged and presented in the book Turtles. I thought that was a masterful exercise of a review of all the science, or lack thereof, around the benefits of vaccines. So I think it's such an amazing book.
Yeah. So, I mean, from my point of view, I think every parent who's thinking about decision should read Turtles All the Way Down and let them make an informed decision. Yep. Because I think, you know, you should be guided by the science and not the myths.
Okay. And, you know, guys, what's really interesting is that most medical doctors will literally condescend to parents and say, you don't know this science like I do. You can't understand the science like I do. And I will tell the parents out there, not only do most parents know more than physicians about vaccines, but most parents can explain it and understand it because it's not rocket science. But the twist and the condescension has made parents so afraid, because when a doctor says, if you don't give your kid the hepatitis B vaccine at birth, your kid will die.
Yeah.
How does a parent take that?
Yeah.
Would you, Larry, argue that vaccines aren't really even taught? I didn't go through pediatric training, but in medical school, I mean, it's almost accepted as a truism. Like, you don't even question or challenge. It's just vaccines are, They've eradicated childhood diseases. They're benefit to mankind, and you just give them. I mean, it's such a big part of pediatrics.
I've never seen any information that would qualify as education in the medical system. There's no question. It is sacrosanct. It is sacrosanct. It is mana from the sky. I mean, it is like the only thing in the world. And you know, look at what you did during 2020, 2021, 2022 in treating patients preemptively with the supplements and the medications you did for COVID. And you saw how people could get better without a shot, and how the emergency use authorization was basically put in place only to enforce a shot and to ignore anything else. And that's why colleagues like you were ostracized and fired and demonized, because you had information that took away their sacred cow, because their agenda was much more insidious and devilish, demonic. Yeah. And so this is what people are waking up to. And again, I never thought COVID was an infection at all. I do think it's a poisoning. I have no problems thinking it was a poisoning. And if therefore it is a poisoning, what is the shot? Because if it's not an infection, then what are you preventing with a shot?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can we do a couple more? We're at the top of the hour, but can you stay on a little bit? Okay.
Go ahead.
I have to leave in five, but. Larry's running the show here.
No. Well, let me get one in here that Pierre, you can probably get on too, and then we'll give them to the ones that are specific to Larry. But do any of you doctors, this is from a viewer, have have any specialized knowledge in vaccine-induced heart problems. How are these problems linked to the vaccines?
Well, I'll go back for years because in 1988, 89, 90, we started seeing something in pediatrics called Kawasaki's disease. And Kawasaki's disease presented with different symptoms in the hands, in the eyes, in the intestines, but also in the coronary arteries. And what happened was the coronary arteries would swell into an aneurysm. And nobody knew what was happening. Nobody knew what was happening. And years later, we figured out that it was thimerosal poisoning.
Ugh.
And so patients would present with Kawasaki's. And if we look back, already by 1987, we had the DPT, which was pure whole cell. It was not acellular. That had thimerosal in it. The MMR, but it was no mercury in there. But the Haemophilus influenza B vaccine was started in 1985. It was an ineffective vaccine. It was reprogrammed and put into place in 1987. And then in 1989, it was given to kids 2 months and older, because up to 1989, it was just 18 months and older. And so here we were seeing Kawasaki's disease in kids older than 18 months. So with the addition of the Haemophilus influenza B with the thimerosal and the DPT and the effects that the MMR had, the kids were just overwhelmed already with the thimerosal. And don't forget, they were on fluoride vitamins. So the combination of metals and fluoride, which are neurotoxic and immunologically toxic, and they were getting these horrible, horrible diseases, which we treated with IVIGG and, you know, IVGG. It was horrible. And these, some of these kids died. That was a well-known, looking back, metal from the vaccines. But then you saw all these people with Guillain-Barré from the flu shot. That was the mercury also. And other things in there, egg protein and who knows what else, cellular materials. And then the flu shot was leading to myocarditis. And I've actually seen kids develop myocarditis after flu shots. And this was after they put the flu shot back in the schedule after 2005, six with thimerosal in it, after we had reduced the thimerosal in the shots in 2002 to 2005 and six. And so, yes, it is an autoimmune attack, just like it is with the COVID shot.
But with the COVID, I've got a couple of friends who've developed really nasty arrhythmias. Never had them before.
Well, again, there are a lot of things, Betsy, in the environment that can challenge the electrical system of the heart. And our phones, our iPads, our laptops, our cell towers, our smart meters, our smart everything, they're affecting the electrical circuits. So what you're seeing not only are arrhythmias in kids and adults, you're seeing seizures because we're really challenging the electrical circuits in our population.
Great.
One question, Larry. In your maybe we'll have you back, because it's really been fascinating listening to you. Do you treat sort of vaccine injuries in children? Is that part of your practice? Do they come to you for that? And have you developed approaches to helping kids who really been? I mean, you're talking about some discrete serious disease, but many of these kids are chronically ill.
So we know that 1 in 5 children in this country have neurodevelopmental disabilities. 1 in 36 are diagnosed with autism, which is part of the 1 in 5. 1 in 10 with ADD and ADHD. 1 in 20 under the age of 5 with seizures, which is from January of 2016. So that's almost 8 years old, that literature. So I see a lot of these kids, and it's a slow peeling the onion process of reducing the inflammation that's coming into their body. so their growth and development can kick in. Because we know, at least from our own immunological learning, that growth and development will slow down if inflammation reaches past a certain threshold. And so the goal is to reduce the inflammation coming into their bodies so that they can get below the threshold whereby growth and development can then kick in again. And so, you know, again, for each kid, it's a different approach. Diet, reducing EMF, maximizing sleep, changing the emotional environment, parenting changes, and then removing the toxins as easily as you can without throwing the kid into a storm that then creates another big problem and they regress again. Parasites are big in these kids. But, you know, Martha Herbert, who's a neurologist, has written extensively now about the roles of EMF in kids with chronic illness, especially the neurodevelopmental disorders. And I try desperately to get the parents to stop giving their kids the iPhones, the iPads, stop putting the cell phone near the ear, stop putting it, the Wi-Fi router near the bed. You know, there's so much that's coming from EMF toxicity that parents don't even know. And Dietrich Klinghardt, who's a well-known physician, will not see patients until they've mitigated their EMF. And I don't blame him, because it's a very caustic inflammatory agent in the body.
We have a question you've got to deal with, because so many parents have to. Jacqueline Penskin says, what are you recommending regarding the immunizations that are required for the child to attend school?
So I ask a different question. Okay. Will your kid be able to learn if you give your kid those shots and send your kid to school? Will your child's brain be the same? And most often not.
So you advocate homeschooling, is that it?
Well, I advocate parents taking a step back and looking at what they're agreeing to. You are allowing a system that wants to willingly poison your kids just for admission into their society, knowing full well that the educational system is no longer geared towards teaching your kids life skills, and no longer geared towards giving your kids the ability to critically think. And so there are some schools that still allow for critical thinking. But if you go back into the history of education in the United States, the intention 100 years ago or more is to reduce critical thinking in children and create good soldiers. And so I'm not making that up. So if you want to create children who are going to think for themselves, learn through experience, and derive at answers through trial and error, then putting them in the school system where they're just being dumped to regurgitate, I would ask you to rethink that.
Okay, doctors, I'm getting the wrap. It's time we have to wrap it up here, but boy, you got to come back. This is good stuff, really good information.
Larry, thank you. That was just superb.
Superb. It was a pleasure to listen to you, Larry. Pleasure.
Indeed. We get a lot more questions next time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. I look forward to further discussions. Education, critical thinking, all encompassed by science. This is science.
Yeah, you just described what we try to do, Larry.
Yes.
Science.
All right. And folks, we have some information for you too that will help remember this. Thank you. So let me find where is my little script with all my notes on it, which would be helpful. All right. Right there, as you see, we've got a parent's guide and Kids Corner coming up, because we don't want to leave this topic without giving you new ways to look at and treat children's health. We want to share a couple of updates from our other pediatrician extraordinaire, Dr. Liz Mumper. She has three new episodes of Kids Corner out, one on food behavior and polyphenols, and one on MISC, or multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children, and a third that will be out tomorrow focusing on pediatric myocarditis. We also have a new guide from Dr. Mumper to help parents facing decisions around childhood vaccinations for their kids. Not easy decisions, as you know. So please check those out. The links on the screen, and make sure to share this information with anyone facing having to make these decisions in the near future. Now then, we have an early announcement of an episode of Long Story Short this week for you that is so relevant to tonight's topic that we didn't want to wait to give it to you. This one discusses a newly published study in preprint that was funded by the FDA showing the presence of a safety signal, seizures, and convulsions in COVID-vaccinated children between the ages of 2 and 5 years old. Wow. Please make sure to check out this episode of Dr. Bean's work. He is a wonderful teacher. He also has a new episode of Long Story Short out that shares a study out of Belgium that demonstrated that the use of standard and low-dose hydroxychloroquine in hospitalized COVID patients reduced mortality by 35%. That's impressive. Another must-watch program. You can find it on our FLCCC Rumble and Odyssey channels, or at flccc.net/Dr. Bean. It's where to find all these good things. Speaking of Dr. Bean, if you haven't headed over to our online FLCCC store for a while, his incredible artwork is featured on many of our designs. So check out supportflccc.store and make sure to use the code LETDOCTORSBEDOCTORS to receive 10% off anything that you buy there. And we thank you for buying there. And with that, let's say thanks to the wonderful nurse, Samantha Hanks, RN, who has been answering your questions online tonight. Samantha, how's it going? You're here solo for this time.
No, without my fearless leader, Christina. We miss her. But
She's allowed to have a week off, I think. Huh?
A week off. That's right. Yep. Yeah. How great. We had about 75 tonight, and I got to 60 of them, which was not
pretty bad. Good. Pretty good. But, and this is an area you know well too, right? In the holistic health.
Yeah, holistic pediatrics. That's kind of my thing. So this was fun for me. I mean, Dr. P, what an amazing doctor. It's so sad we don't have more of them. But the fact that he's getting the word out and helping people to learn about this stuff is just fabulous. So hats off to him.
And thank you for helping too. We were just glad to have you. Thank you. Thank you. And finally, folks, we have to thank you. We are so grateful that you're all here tonight, that you are with us on this journey week in and week out. You know, our mission is, as always, to work to empower all of you in medicine and to save more lives. And you help us to do just that, you know. So thank you for your support, for your generosity. It is, as Dr. Marek so rightly says, truly astonishing. Yes, yes. And with that, we will see you next week. But first, watch what one of our traveling supporters shared with us. A good story.
Quarantine Grecian style. Recently, my wife and I were touring Greece. Halfway into the tour, I became extremely ill and tested positive for COVID. My wife and I were required, as per protocol, to quarantine on Mykonos for 5 days, plus one 24-hour re-entry day. Luckily, we had brought with us the FLCCC iCare travel kit, unfortunately minus one important medication, ivermectin, which had worked for me 18 months earlier. We were put up in a 4-star hotel, in separate rooms. We were allowed to go out in public and relax poolside. We could also walk into a small seaside village, with spas, boutiques, and restaurants while in quarantine. We found out through one of the local pharmacists that ivermectin was available, but only if you were from the EU or other nation states, and not the United States. Only remdesivir or Paxlovid were the meds to be given, as per USA CDC guidelines. Ivermectin was forbidden. For me, being a 72-year-old male, with a history of asthma and bronchitis, it was not good news. After the quarantine, we limped back to our home in Maine, and felt safe again, as I had acquired a prescription for ivermectin through doctors working with my Carefree MD affiliates. I'd learned about them while following, and donating to, the FLCCC. My wife and I find it such a relief that the FLCCC are there for us and many others who seek trustworthy advice.
Your stories are powerful. They change hearts and minds. Share yours today. Send it in to mystory@flccc.net.